Today in Studio 360, Sloane Crosley is known for her witty, well-observed essays about modern life. But now that she's writing fiction, she refuses to let her characters just stand there being witty and observant.
I think that it's indulgent to do a 300-page description of the ice in someone's whiskey glass and an oak tree. I mean, get out of the country.
So she puts her characters in a love triangle and sends them on an international caper. Plus, nothing in the world sounds quite like Coco Rosie.
Someone's gonna take you home.
With a knapsack of trinket, I'm off to seek my fortune.
The two sisters behind those songs are here and are about to do their bewitching thing.
Stick out your thumb and lift up your skirt. Someone's gotta stop you.
That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show, Sloane Crosley was a very successful book publicist. And on the side, a successful book writer. She put out two best-selling collections of essays, I Was Told There'd Be Cake and How Did You Get This Number? But what she really wanted was to write novels. So she decided to quit the 9-to-5 and write full-time. And that worked out well. Her debut novel is out right now. The Clasp is about three old college buddies who get reacquainted at a friend's wedding and find they still have all their old love triangle-ish feelings. From there, they get pulled into a mystery involving international travel, fabulous antique jewelry, and the 19th century French writer Guy de Maupassant. It's every bit as funny and charming and smart and observant as her essays, plus that page-turning plot. And unlike some comic novels, heart. And Sloane Crosley joins me now. Hiya, and welcome.
Thank you. That was such a nice introduction.
So we can quit.
Okay, that's it. We can go home now.
So you graduated from college knowing you wanted to write fiction, but didn't do it immediately. Was that because you had to earn a living or because you wanted to wait until you had enough accumulated life experience and wisdom that was worth transmuting into fiction?
Well, I think probably more the former, only because I think that the novel probably benefits from more life wisdom and experience. But that hasn't stopped anyone with no life wisdom and experience from writing a novel.
And some of them can do it.
Right. And some of them can do it extremely well. Oh. But for me, I'm actually happy you asked that question because people always assume everything is quite intentional and that something as sort of base as actually having to earn a living might get in your way. And I was fortunate in the fact that I found two careers that I really loved, nonfiction and really being a book publicist, that were gratifying and distracting enough, but they couldn't distract me forever from what I really wanted to do, which was this.
Having been in the publishing world, read hundreds of books, promoting other people's books, all that, in any way, did it help you write a novel?
It's funny. I heard Ann Patchett give an interview once about her mother, who's also a famous novelist. And she said that, you know, in my house, it was always possible to be a novelist. It was always – that was a conceivable profession. And my parents, while incredibly literate, smart people, are not literary people. And, you know, I come from sort of suburban 401k, get your homework in on time environment. So to me, it almost felt like an Onion headline, you know, leaving publishing, you know, nice girl from suburbs leaves – good job for no health insurance. But being around these authors who did it for a living made it sort of conceivable for me late in life.
It demystified it
a
bit.
Yes.
Yeah. You worked full time every day in an office for a dozen years. Did that give you enough discipline that you have been able in the 5 years you've been on your own working in your apartment to go to the desk and do the writing at 9 a.m. every morning? Or have you had to create new ways to give yourself discipline without lists of stuff that a job gives you to do?
I am largely motivated by fear. It's really worked very well for me so far. And one of the things I did when I quit was tell the New York Times I was writing a novel. So I thought, well, now I'm beholden to do it. I know there are people that I find it very admirable that they say nothing until there's an auction.
So you quit your job without knowing exactly what this novel was, without having sold it.
Yes, I hadn't sold the novel. It's a crazy thing I did. I mean, it's got a bit of a Jerry Maguire quality to it, if you want to, where I just sort of thought I'm taking this fish and getting out of here.
Yeah.
And then that's sort of the larger motivation to write every day, to know that this thing had been put out there, or this gauntlet had been thrown.
Yeah. So will you read something from the book?
I will.
And what is going on at this point?
Victor, who's one of our three main characters, has just been fired from his job at a middling search engine for pitching a hipster search engine, a search engine within a search engine. So it was a pretty horrible idea. But then he sort of quickly spirals into depression. He knew that this was the start of a new life. As homely as the old one was, this one was going to be straight up ugly. The whole company was in trouble. When your aim as a corporation is to unseat the sixth largest version of your corporation, you're legally working on the set of a Christopher Guest film. But being the first to be let go was humiliating. Without the alignment of lunch and commuting schedules, Victor quickly lost touch with the handful of coworkers he liked. He would do nothing all day but plan on doing other things. He trolled employment websites, took naps, and drank early. Some days he knew it was raining only because his mail was wet. He ate foods that could survive nuclear attacks. Oh, hello, frozen burrito, old friend. How I've missed ignoring your suggestion that I cook you on high for 3 minutes, flip you over, and cook you on high for 3 minutes again.
That was Sloane Crosley reading from her new novel, The Clasp. Do you feel that of these three main characters, there's one that is most like you?
Well, I thought starting to write a novel that's in the third person, that's two-thirds told from, you know, two different men's perspectives. I thought I would be relieved to get to the female perspective, but actually she is probably the least like me, I think.
And this is probably, don't take this the wrong way, but the two men, especially the manliest of them, you write very, very convincingly in their attitudes toward, I don't know, life, sex especially.
Oh, thank you.
Well done.
Thanks.
Did it feel, though, when you were writing the men, like, oh, this is more fiction because I'm not a man? Did it feel more like I'm definitely writing fiction, not just putting my essayistic voice into a female character?
It did. It felt more, the part that felt more like writing fiction is actually not going into the different genders, but delving into three different professions, none of which I've held. So I've never been fired from a search engine, nor been employed at a search engine. I've never worked in the independent jewelry.
But you're a writer, like the third character.
The third character, I'm a writer, but he's so thoroughly Hollywood, you know, and of a certain generation in Hollywood.
Yeah. For the first third of the book, you're reading along, and it seems to be this one thing, which is this not particularly plotty portrait of these friends, these 29-year-olds. And then it suddenly, well into it, more than 100 pages in, turns into this other thing, this romantic mystery. Was that the notion from the get-go, or were you just like, yeah, oh, I know, I'll set them on this global adventure?
It was pretty much the notion from the get-go.
Yeah.
You can't take credit for, like, full intentionality. I mean, there's obviously, when you're writing a book, things that switch, things that change.
Yep.
It's like a sort of really intimidating giant Jenga set that lives in your living room that you have to constantly be careful what you pull at.
What is a Jenga set?
It's a giant it's a Jenga game.
I'm gesticulating. I thought it was an animal that I didn't know.
A Jenga set.
Yes.
That sounds like such a great name. The endangered Jenga set.
Kind of a lemur with...
It does have a lemur, red panda feel to it. But that is not... that's not it. No, you know, I think that I wanted them to leave the house. And I wanted them to be both sort of rewarded and punished for their inertia. You know, as amusing as you can possibly make dialogue, I think that it's indulgent to do a 300-page description of the ice in someone's whiskey glass and an oak tree. I mean, get out of the country.
So the novel revolves around this short story called The Necklace. One of your main characters tells another of the characters that she's an idiot for not knowing this famous story. But for the idiots among us, explain this story in a nutshell.
In a nutshell, okay. Basically, it's the story of a woman who's a social climbing woman whose husband procures her an invitation to a ball thinking she'll be very excited. But she's devastated because she doesn't have anything to wear. So she borrows a very expensive, the most expensive necklace that she can from the most wealthy friend that she can, has the night of her life, is walking along the banks of the Seine, feels up at her neck at the end of the night and realizes that she's lost it. So they can't find it, the husband and wife. And so what they do is they go out, buy a replacement necklace and give it to her. And then 20 years later, meanwhile, they go into debt trying to work off the debt. They take all sorts of odd jobs. You know, that being on the cusp of society is no longer really a part of their concern because she's scrubbing floors. And she runs into the rich woman at the very end of the story. And it's famous for its ending because the rich woman looks at her and says, oh, my dear, it was glass. It was fake. So all of her life has been for nothing. Basically, she's been chasing a false goal.
And so it, as one of the characters says to another, oh, yeah, he's like the French O. Henry. It has that O. Henry-ish
the twist.
And so but at what point after age 14 did you decide one day I'm going to write a novel around this French short story?
I was in my apartment one night after I'd already quit my job, and I felt frustrated by these characters I was writing. I felt that they didn't really have the heartbeat that I wanted them to have. I knew vaguely what I wanted to happen, but not really. And, you know, as many writers do for inspiration, I picked up something that I knew for sure would be better than what I was writing. And so I picked up a classic collection of short stories that always makes me feel better. And there's certain writing that can intimidate you and alienate you, and short stories never do that for me. And so I started reading The Necklace and was just, I felt it was such a perfectly neat, I mean, the same thing that makes it an O. Henry-esque story. It's this very neat, almost fable-esque story that I could hang my hat on, and that also had these very contemporary themes of wish fulfillment and love
and class and wealth.
And class
which
and
are
wealth
issues you
and
deal
striving
with.
Yeah. And it just, it became sort of this like heartbeat between or for each of the characters.
Yeah. The novel also reminded me as I was reading it of great 1930s and 40s screwball film comedies, like A Philadelphia Story crossed with The Lady Eve or something. Are you a fan of those films? Is that part of your inspirational fodder?
Oh, wow. Philadelphia Story is probably my favorite movie. So, yes. I mean, there's actually – that movie is so brilliantly done and so funny. But has so much heart to it. I mean, it also has so much misogyny to it. It's an old movie.
Yeah.
But I think what I really love is entertaining fiction that is not lowbrow. And I think, I don't know if I hit the note or not, but that was the note I was trying to hit. You know, you should entertain people. And so I love those comedies for those reasons.
Yeah. So essays, fiction, if you had your druthers, which would you prefer to be doing?
Oof, probably both. I mean, that's what's weird is people, I think, sometimes inadvertently talk about the essays as if I've sloughed them off or they were just sort of, you know, the guys I dated until I found this one to marry.
Right.
And I don't feel that way about
it. You have
that.
An open marriage with the novel
and
the
essays.
I have an
open marriage. Yeah, exactly.
Well, keep doing it because it's just a lovely piece of work and a great way to spend a few hours.
Wow, thank you so much.
And thank you for being here.
I love being here.
Sloane Crosley's new novel, The Clasp, is out right now. In a perfect world, all of the talented among us could quit our jobs and write novels or sculpt or paint or make music full time. But real life being what it is, that stuff usually gets squeezed between urgent obligations. Earning a living, taking care of family, visits to the podiatrist. The creative projects are left half done or undone. Well, at the beginning of this year, we introduced you to four people who said, "This is it. This is the year I actually do my creative dream project." Kara Stiles is one of them. Her New Year's resolution was to make one original diorama every month for all of 2015. The scenes she crafts are sometimes religious-ish, sometimes personal, but always, always full of cat stickers. With just a few months left in the year, we checked in with Kara at her apartment in Oakland.
So it's a lot of junk. It's a lot of things I've cut out, things I found, little things I've been gifted. I have a lot of cat stickers. I have a picture of not the current Pope, but Pope Benedict that I might do something with. There's usually part of my process where I'm taking a bunch of stuff from like this art bookcase I have. I'm putting them out on the floor, looking at the different supplies I have, kind of testing out what things go together and making different piles. I've been making one every month, but I have not been finishing one every month. So since about May, I have not been able to finish one. They're
just sitting there. I can't figure out what the next step is and how to complete it.
The piece I'm working on right now, I've decided to kind of make, this is going to sound, well, whatever, it's going to maybe sound a little weird, but trying to make basically a coffin to say goodbye and to kind of honor parts of myself that I think are changing and in some ways kind of dying off. There's just like this story I've told myself about myself and a way I've conceptualized my life up until now. I'm kind of done with that story and I don't really want that story anymore. And so this is kind of my send-off piece to that. I can't find words for those parts, but I can find symbols for them. And so maybe about 10, 12 years ago, I did this shamanic class, and I made a little death mask. It's basically just a plaster mask of my face. Since I've painted it kind of like a purple mauve kind of color, I happen to have this really big shadow box. People put like their American flag in it or their diploma and like that kind of thing. So far all I've done is just glitter the back of it with black and blue and a little bit of silver glitter. And I'm going to put this purple mask of my face in it. And I want to find some fake flowers and just have them kind of weaving through like the eye holes. And then I have a bunch of cat stickers, of course, that will somehow find their way in it. And that's where it is right now.
My name is Rachel Marcus. I'm Karis's girlfriend, and I also live here. She'll often send me and other friends texts of the images that she's working on or be like kind of tinkering with something and be like, what do you think I should do here? I'm not quite sure. I don't know what to tell you most of the time, but like just the fact that you want me in it or looking at it is very sweet. Can I tell this story?
Yeah.
Okay. On one of our first dates, Karis texted me a picture of a cat face on a hunky man's body, and that pretty much sealed the deal.
You can see some of those cat sticker-studded dioramas on our website, studio360.org. I happen to love them. We'll be updating you on our other resolution makers as the clock ticks down to 2016. And thanks to Ike Shrieskandaraja for that story. Coming up...
If the Norse can do it, if the Aztecs can do it, if Socrates could do it, if Philip Pullman can write about it, then I can have a demon too.
Things are about to get a little demonic, but in a good way. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. It's fall, and with fall, even in this new day and age, comes a bunch of new TV shows. So you can spend your after-work hours watching the revamped Muppet Show on ABC.
Where the first guest here again is the first issue.
Or singing along to a new musical comedy on the CW.
West Covina, California.
Or glued to a violent drama set in the 1300s.
Censorship will not suffer lawlessness.
That's on FX. Of course, you could also spend that time watching shiny new offerings from HBO or Showtime or IFC or AMC or Hulu or Amazon or Netflix. Golden age of TV, right? Well, in a recent speech that sort of freaked out Hollywood, John Landgraf, the CEO of FX, said there is now, quote, simply too much television. In fact, this year, there'll be more than 400 current scripted comedy and drama series to watch. 400 now running. In other words, the golden age is a glut, and he says, something's got to give. John Landgraf joins me now. John, welcome to Studio 360.
Happy to be here, Kurt.
So let's say there is too much television. So what? What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah. I don't think there is a worst that can happen. It's not as if we're talking about too many guns in America. Too much television doesn't have quite the same consequence, does it?
But from your perspective, what's the problem?
Objectively, I think the business model can't sustain this many programs. So I think there will be a peak. And again, I could be wrong, but I think that peak television will be reached sometime this year or next year. Certainly, there have been people who critiqued my comments by saying, well, you know, that's just a somebody who runs a business who doesn't like the fact there's more openness in his business and more people coming in, or even worse, maybe a white man who, you know, is defending nostalgically white male privilege and, you know, isn't thrilled about all these women and other people coming in. And, you know, everybody has the right to perceive whatever they want or say whatever they want. But that's not what I was saying. I was saying that there's something in the American psyche. I think one of the reasons that we're kind of a dyspeptic culture is that mm-hmm. we have so much choice that we're actually kind of cynical and bitter about the amount of choice we have, right? There's a body of literature on the so-called paradox of choice that basically says that when you give somebody too many choices, you actually diminish the joy they get out of what choices they make. I think that this is more than the optimal amount. I think we're giving people so much choice that we're creating this paradox of choice where it just making a choice becomes work.
Well, it certainly is different than back in the day when there were three networks.
Right.
For sure.
Certainly, I think in general, more points of view is a good thing. If stories are empathy machines that allow us to see through the eyes of and live in the skin of other people, then many different kinds of people telling stories that are important to them, probably a good thing. By the way, I want to qualify this by saying, you know, if you look at the number of people that are currently watching Transparent, it would fall below the threshold of this so-called happy optimum. And yet I'm not arguing that Transparent shouldn't exist or that it's not a good thing that Transparent exists mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. it's beloved and award-winning. I think there's room for small shows. Louie is an example of a small show that FX made that I'm very proud of. I think television can and should make shows that are watched by 3 or 4 million people. I just think that if you can't make any shows that aren't the Super Bowl that are going to be watched by 20 million people, the medium is different then, and it's not a part of a common dialogue. It becomes a part of this fractured world that we live in America, where everybody goes to their corner, right? And the liberal people watch the liberal news, and the conservative people watch the conservative news, and we're not having a common experience anymore.
Well, and it is what has happened in literature, in music. It just may be that it's what's happened to culture, and now television is joining the phenomenon. Are you going to... I guess the phrase is eat your own dog food in terms of your theory. Are you gonna slow down the number of new shows and try to pick the ones that are not derivative and not just feeding the maw? How does this affect the way you do your job, this theory of yours that we're at peak television?
I am going to try to first of all, there's an implication in the question that we're a part of the problem, and I accept and agree with that implication that,
good.
You know, we went from 0 to 20 shows, so it's hard for me to then raise my hand and complain. On the other hand, at least for me, what I've realized is we're at the absolute limit of what we can do well.
Have you had an experience as this moment has loomed of having a good show, a show that you thought was great on the air that couldn't get the attention that you thought it deserved because of the clutter of 400 shows?
A recent example for me is The Comedians, which was a show that starred Billy Crystal and Josh Gad and
right.
was, I thought, a really terrific show. A lot of people didn't like the pilot very much and just didn't have the time to keep watching it. And there were some, I think, magnificent episodes of that show that were made toward the end, but we just couldn't get anybody's attention. Ultimately, even those whose job it is to sort of sift through the dung heap of rejected shows and find those little, you know, partially undigested carrots. What an awful metaphor. I'm really sorry. they just don't have the patience to do it anymore.
A million radios just turned off.
I know. I'm so sorry.
I think you're probably right that experience, not liking the first show or two of a series, but then people stick with it, is probably rare. You just don't have the time to stick with something that isn't immediately satisfying you.
Well, and if it's not perfect for you now, then with all those options that you haven't even explored, and this comes back to the paradox of choice, you just say, well, I'm just going to set this aside and go keep exploring. And so to some extent, you could find yourself infinitely and endlessly exploring for that perfect thing.
So it's like internet dating and Tinder, where people just, sorry, not attractive enough. Oh, nope, one date, going on, moving on to the next. I guess it's the same thing.
Exactly.
John Landgraf, thank you very much.
Happy to talk to you, Kurt, anytime.
John Landgraf is the CEO of FX. So, people, what do you think? Is there too much TV competing for your time and mental bandwidth? Or the more the merrier? Let us know at studio360.org. I love hearing stories of how some work of art or piece of entertainment has changed somebody's life. Julia Pawlowski was a bookish kid. When she was 9, she took The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, a 1,200-page history book, to summer camp. That's bookish. And true to type, I know from experience, she was also kind of an introvert.
When I was a small child, I was actually a very shy person, really pretty much a doormat. I had a habit of attaching myself to girls who were much more popular and vocal than me and essentially just following them and doing whatever they told me to do. I had a speech impediment. I've gotten over it since. I had a hard time reading social cues. So I had this vast desire to have conversation and to connect, but it was very difficult for me. But I also had a very active fantasy life. I mean, I had a very active internal life.
The book that changed Julia's life out of all the ones she'd read was Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass, which came out in 1995 and was the first book in the fantasy trilogy called His Dark Materials.
There was so much about it that really caught me. First off, it had this female protagonist of the age I was reading it. Lyra Silvertongue, the main character, was 13 as well. And I also loved all the different worlds that were imagined in this book. And then, of course, there was the demons.
Even if you don't know you've got a demon, you have. You wouldn't be human else. You'd be half dead.
So, just to be clear, this isn't a demon like in a horror movie. Philip Pullman was borrowing the idea of the demons, that's D-A-E-M-O-N, from the Greeks. Plato writes about Socrates talking to his daimon, a voice inside his head, like an imaginary guide. In The Golden Compass, your demon is real. It takes the form of an animal.
A demon is the other half of your inner dialogue, is the way I like to think of it. The way most people usually work out thoughts in their own head, the characters in this book would work these things out between human and demon. And when you're young, the animal changes from form to form, whatever you feel like at the moment, whatever represents what's going on right now.
Her demon's name was Pantalaimon, and he was currently in the form of a moth, a dark brown one, so as not to show up in the darkness of the hall.
Hiding and spying is for silly children.
Oh, exactly what I knew you'd say. Now stop nagging.
The two of them sat in silence for a while, Lyra uncomfortable on the hard floor of the wardrobe, and Pantalaimon self-righteously twitching his temporary antennae on one of the robes.
Lyra is 13 in this series, so Pantalaimon, for the vast majority of the series, doesn't have a fixed form. He changes a lot, but he has certain favorite forms that he takes. So he takes the form of a little brown moth. He likes to be a wildcat. Usually when Lyra's feeling, like, angry and incensed, he'll become a wildcat and put his fur up and growl. You know, he can be a rat when she's feeling kind of suspicious. And so I liked this idea of some way to express emotion that was not verbal and was not typical body language either. It was just like this, just pouring yourself into this animal shape. When I was 15, I was spending the summer doing an internship at a genetics lab. I really liked the internship, but I got pretty bored and alone during the breaks. And I remember one lunch break, I was in the lab, and I remember remembering the demons and how cool they were and how much they fascinated me. So I decided to read about them online. I thought somebody must have written something about this. And I guess what I found that really spoke to me was that this idea of the demon was actually a widespread human experience. Lots of people have thought about this. So there's the daimon. And then there's the aspect of, like, an animal representing yourself, which is common in a lot of cultures. There's the Nahual in Aztec culture, and there's something called a Fylgia in Norse culture. And so I found through my research that this was, like, a really widespread human experience. It wasn't just something that Philip Pullman pulled up out of nowhere. And that's when I decided, if the Norse can do it, if the Aztecs can do it, if Socrates could do it, if Philip Pullman can write about it, then I can have a demon too. So the first thing I did is I was sitting in my genetics lab and I decided, okay, right here, right now, I'm going to picture a demon with me. And he'll be with me just like Pantalaimon's with Lyra all the time. So I pictured a canary perched on the lab bench. And then I went off to get my sandwich for lunch break, and he flew with me down the street, and I just focused on keeping him very clear in my mind, like picturing him. How are his wings moving as I move down the street? Like, I'm stopping by the stand to buy the sandwich. Where is he perched right now? What is he looking at? Over the years, my demon took many different forms. It's almost always been birds. I liked this way of expressing myself, like the fact that they could appear so different from one another. I mean, there's everything from plain black ravens to scarlet macaws that are in a rainbow of colors. Another thing that happened around that time was that that I was starting to understand myself as being gay. I remember he said to me, let's spend a day just like with the thought in mind, like, I am gay. Let's just go through the day like that and see what happens. I would spend a day being gay and only my demon knew about it. He didn't even say anything when I came out to my parents. He was just perched on my arm, and just like that feeling of him being there was so important when I was coming out. So in the world of His Dark Materials, when you're a kid, you're in the series, your demon represents your emotions at the moment, or how you feel at the moment, so it changes all the time. But when you become an adult, it settles into a shape that represents who you are.
We used to talk about Pan settling, him and me. We used to wonder what he'd be.
Don't people have any idea?
Not when they're young. As you grow up, you start thinking, well, they might be this or they might be that. And usually they end up something that fits. I mean, something like your real nature.
But I'm not in the world of His Dark Materials, and so my demon won't magically settle on his own as something that represents me without my input. I had to find it out for myself. And so that meant a lot of research into different animals and trying to find out which one's behavior matched me. So the animal I ended up settling on is a jackdaw. Jackdaws are these very common relatives of crows. And like crows, they're very curious animals. They always, when they encounter something new, they pick it up and poke at it to find out if it could be food. They're very resourceful, adaptable animals, and they're just as common as weeds. Jackdaws form very strong social relationships with other jackdaws, and they cement it by doing mutual feeding. They'll take some of their favorite food items that they find and give it to their friend, and then the friend will give it back. They're also very playful animals. They have a sense of humor insofar as you could say an animal has one, but if anything does, it's crows and their relatives. These birds are very competitive. So I recognize in myself that I have a very strong, ambitious, competitive streak, which is not always my best quality, but it can sometimes be a good quality too. So now I'm 24, and I'm a PhD student in biology at Tufts University. I study social behavior in paper wasps. And honestly, a lot of my encyclopedic knowledge about animals just comes from having researched them for my demon form. So these days I don't converse with my demon as much, and I don't visualize him as much, though when I'm working on my own, then I'll visualize him on my desk. He kind of keeps me on track a lot. I have a very, well, magpie mind. A jackdaw mind, right? I just still find it so soothing, just like picturing him flying with me as I walk around.
Julia Pawlowski lives in Boston, where this show airs on WGBH, and our story was produced by Zoe Azoulay with help from Josh Rogerson. Has a piece of literature or a movie or play or album or building changed your life? Tell us about it at studio360.org. We might put your story on the air. Still ahead, the band Coco Rosie says their life in the south of France is not exactly the glamorous scene you think of as the south of France.
Yeah, we're not doing the aperitivo or the cheese thing exactly. We're like, you know, hijacking old tractors, burning dead cats.
And, of course, making that music. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. The sisters Sierra and Bianca Cassidy were born and raised in the United States, raised all over the United States, as a matter of fact. But 10 years ago, when they each found themselves in Paris, they decided to start making music together under the name Coco Rosie. I first heard them a dozen years ago when my then 14-year-old daughter introduced me to that song off their first record, La Maison de Mon Rêve, which translates as My Dream House. It was like nothing I'd ever heard, and I immediately fell in love. The mix of Sierra's beautiful, classically trained voice with Bianca's spoken word rap thing, with all these sounds made from toys and children's instruments, the component parts were very simple and familiar, but the whole was so unique and rich. They've made 5 equally strange and wonderful records since then and collaborated with the coolest of the cool kids, Devendra Banhart, Anthony of Anthony and the Johnsons, the theater director Robert Wilson. Their new record, called Heartache City, is out now, and they are temporarily back in the USA. Sierra and Bianca Cassidy, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
You grew up in the United States of America, although sometime in Hawaii, which only half counts. But you live in France, and you've lived in France for now, you know, most of your adult life. What's so good about France for you?
I wonder the same thing sometimes. Really.
Yeah.
I'm in love with West Texas, and for me, the South of France is really similar to West Texas.
In what possible way?
Well, there's tumbleweeds.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And there's...
Oh, so you're in the South. Oh, there you go.
It's just funky and trashy. And, it's not...
Cowboys. Lots of cowboys.
It's not as, really? It's not as pristine as...
This is a different version of the South of France one is used to.
Yeah, we're not doing the aperitivo or the cheese thing. Exactly. Yeah. We're like, you know, hijacking old tractors and...
That sounds good.
Burning dead cats.
What do your neighbors think of you?
We get called gypsies as an insult.
I can imagine.
For, like, leaving our clothing on the clothing line when we leave the country. And then we come back. My favorite shirt I left hanging in a tree, and it was there a year later.
Huh. Because they were afraid of your gypsy curse, I guess.
Yeah.
Will you play something now off this new record? How about Lost Girls?
Yeah, we'd love to.
Close your eyes and you can fly. I'm off to meet my soulmate, a naked, funny jailbait, waiting. Riding into ponds filled with pollywogs at dawn, owning the light that slipped from my eyes. A little child with dirty hair, with dirty nails, I had dirty things sprawled upon my mind. I had such dirty things.
That was Coco Rosie playing Lost Girls off their new record, Heartache City. They are joined by Tez on beatbox and Takuya on keyboards and trumpets and various other mysterious sounds. Lots and lots of bands and musicians combine, obviously, these days, electronics and voice and analog and everything. But I honestly don't know any music that does it more to my satisfaction than you. I mean, it's just the perfect combination of the real and the digital. I guess digital is real, but you know what I mean.
Thanks.
That was Lost Girls. You recently collaborated with the theater director, Robert Wilson, on a production of Peter Pan. And I'm wondering if this Lost Girls has any connection to the Lost Boys of Peter Pan.
It does. When we were working on that play, we started kind of rewriting everything. Sierra was Hook for a while, and we turned the Lost Boys into Lost Girls. And
just in your own sort of
both in it
life, no,
in every sense, we get very personally invested in our creative process, we start kind of living it out. So, yeah.
You're method musicians.
Yeah, method musicians. But it definitely, it planted the seed for this song.
Huh.
It's not always a literal thing, but the title, which a lot of things come from titles,
right,
in our world. So
childhood actually appears in your music again and again, both in lyrical terms and in various sounds and voices. Do your childhoods loom large for you as a thing to inspire you?
They sure do. And they're, I don't know if it's ever a creative reservoir that will ever run dry or not. You know, we dig in there a lot. We're really interested in kind of working out all of the shadow stuff in our psyche. So that takes us constantly back to the childhood world. And there's a lot of kind of transcending of darkness within our music, and so that takes us there. And
that you experience as children.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel so much like going back. It feels like acknowledging that all of that is here all of the time, and just kind of, you know, setting the table for all those different selves to come out.
Yeah. Did moving around a lot, do you think, help prepare you for, like, being on tour, not living in Iowa, all that?
Yeah, that's for sure. We have, like, definitely, a kind of a road addiction.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you go to school growing up, like regular schools?
Sierra's the only person in our family to graduate high school.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What is it, 9 kid out of 12 kids? And I just love that. But we did take a photograph for our grandparents where I stole someone's hat and I got inside her graduation robe. Uh-huh. And it looked like
we were one arm and one
and
arm.
Nobody asked why we graduated at the same time. And we took a photograph for our grandparents. Just so because they were actually really big on education, extremely educated people, and really wanted everybody to be educated. And every kid in the family just flunked out and moved out.
And these are half siblings and siblings.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. Both. Yeah. I mean, just everybody flunked out.
Huh.
Except Sierra. She's our she's our academic.
These are your mother's parents?
Those are the ones that we fooled.
Yeah. And so did they go, what have I done wrong that all my grandchildren are not finishing school?
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. Bianca, you said to an interviewer not long ago, music is just our ticket onto the roller coaster, which I loved as a line. What did you mean?
I think what we meant was that, well, I could say as a poet for sure that giving poetry through music is much more accessible, interesting, kind of widespreading, more widely received. And so I felt like, I definitely felt like as a writer, I was kind of just like slipping into this musical thing as a way to give this thing out, you know, not like, hey, did you see my little book?
Yes.
You know, with black letters on it. So that's one way. But also it's been a constant flowing of invitations to other kind of creative projects.
And the idea of it's your ticket on the roller coaster, I'm going to start saying that all the time because I think it applies to many realms. But do you feel like – by roller coaster, do you mean fun or do you mean roller coaster in the sense of there's ups and there's downs?
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
The roller coaster also being like you don't know what's ahead. You can't anticipate that big drop
right.
where your stomach flips or – you know, we really love being challenged and just like diving into things,
uh-huh.
and that's we've had that opportunity many times.
Yeah. Well, I am so pleased you came and so pleased you exist. Thank you.
Oh, thank you,
thank you.
And will you play us out with one more song?
Yes.
Tim and Tina.
Tim and Tina.
You got it.
Who are your parents?
Yes,
Tim and Tina. Which we said
because they appeared in one of your earlier songs.
I know we said pretty much the same thing that Tim and Tina are our parents' names. Sometimes you just gotta tell it like it is.
Well, play.
Okay, here we go.
Like butterflies. Like butterflies. She
was 29, mother of one blonde son. She liked butterflies. She was married, so was he, to a liar she wanted free. They got me married, another three. Round blue-eyed babies had Tim and she.
That's Coco Rosie performing Tim and Tina off their new record, Heartache City. You can hear that full track as well as another song the band played for us at studio360.org. And that's all for this week. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Louis Mitchell,
Sean Ramisferum,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Emil Klein,
Elizabeth Kulas,
Caroline Lester,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, The X-Files is returning to TV, and conspiracy freaks couldn't be more pleased.
I had been exploring what's been going on this planet, kind of behind the scenes, and The X-Files revealed some of that stuff.
Meet the real-life Mulder and Scully next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.